Trans media, new media, social media, there are a lot of buzzwords to describe where content and brands are going in the digital age. In fact, there are probably so many different terms assumed to be describing the same thing that we might be losing sight of what we're trying to describe in the first place. Co-opted by savvy advertising agencies, consultants, and web startups, a lot of money has been won and lost trying to nail down the model for success in the digital age. Sarah Salovitz, founder and CEO of the firm 7Robot, decided to adopt the phrase social design to describe her firm's work connecting people and brands through multimedia. Sarah is also a Harvard Law graduate and former Berkman Fellow with over a decade of experience in working in old and new media, producing a number of successful web shows such as Zaproot and Alive in Baghdad, and consulting with brands, businesses, and content creators of all shapes and sizes. She recently stopped by the Berkman Center to talk about what social design is and how people and companies are learning to engage with content and with each other on and offline.
So social design's a term that I use to define my company, 7Robot. And what social design really is it's how you build a community where your users might be. And that could be anywhere from in real space to on the internet to on television. It's more figuring out how to build incentives for people to participate within the stories and content that you're sharing.
And social design is a very conscious choice for a way you describe what you do. Can you talk about that decision to use that term?
What I've found is in the past few years that like the term social media has become very popular, and yet it still means a lot of things in the same way that kind of transmedia does. And so as we were seeking to define our company, we really wanted to be the people to define it. So when I say social media to someone, they know what it means already. When I say social design, the first question they ask is, well, what does that mean? I don't understand that. And so it allows us to say that like we do very specific things that are different from other people, and that, you know, that our work has integrity, unlike many of the charlatans they might encounter in other spaces. And what we found, you know, I talk about how people hear the word creative. And so when I was in earlier portions of my career, I was very concerned with saying that I was creative and I wanted to be paid to be creative. And I realized that actually the response I was having from people in business was that when they heard creative, what they actually heard was that they're not creative. And it raised these sort of levels of insecurity that like, oh, I'm not this, I'm not that. And therefore, I don't really have to pay you for that because that doesn't have any value. When you use the word entrepreneur, they have a very different response because they know exactly what you're after. And largely, they tend to mean the same things. And so as I stopped using creative, I found that people are more likely to pay us.
Well, let's go back to the social design idea. And what kind of examples have you seen of where this really works well?
I think it is actually what's working well. Like my favorite version of this most recently is the Domino's pizza commercial that Crispin Porter and Bogusky put out with Domino's. And what they did was, if you haven't seen it, what they did was their pizza commercials are focused, the first commercial set are focus groups with their consumers who felt that their pizza tasted like cardboard and that it was disgusting. And so you see the reactions of the very humbled Domino's employees and their efforts to change it. And they have changed it. And what they did was they created a transparent relationship with their consumers, and their consumers have become a part of their brand. So for anybody that received that pizza, you know, that they said the pizza was disgusting, and then Domino's came and brought them a pizza that had responded to their critique that they liked. I mean, they're going to be a customer forever. There's no question. They are a part of the brand. They feel like they've been listened to, and they have. I mean, it's not just they feel like it. It's that, you know, that's what Domino's has decided to do with their brand. I think that is the future. I think it's what Pepsi's doing. I think it's what lots of companies are doing. I'm not sure that it will, you know, reach all quadrants all the time. I mean, someone asked whether that applies to DuPont. I think it depends on who your customers are. If your customers are large institutions that don't necessarily have the same relationship to transparency that consumers are demanding, maybe you won't have to. I'm hopeful because I think that, again, people do wind up being a part of the brands that they feel like are listening to them. And I think that's how you increase value and profits. And if you look at the numbers for Domino's, their stock price is significantly increased and they can't keep pizza boxes in their stores because people are buying pizza so fast. So I feel like, you know, that's a very good sign for putting consumers first. There's still a lot of resistance on the part of business and IP owners to see that this is, you know, what their future may look like, because it is the opposite of what they've done for you know, the past 50 years at least. But I don't know. I mean, I am an optimist. I think that, like, building new businesses like Twitter that are simply about transparency and making it easier to connect people rather than increasing inefficiencies and more clicks like Facebook does, you know, has to be the future. That said, there are many more users on Facebook than there are on Twitter. So, you know, maybe I'm wrong.
This week on Radio Berkman, we're speaking with social design expert Sarah Salovitz. Sarah and I had a long conversation on the future of advertising and user experiences online. Sarah compares Twitter and Facebook and the battles they've fought trying to find the delicate balance between making themselves useful to users and actually making money.
We're reconfiguring how advertising works. And I actually will give Facebook, because of the apps, a lot of credit for this, because they understood they could sell something else instead of banners and clicks. And that's what they have been selling. And I don't think those people can leave Facebook. Like, there's no place else to go for them. And there is a massive, you know, amount of people there. I just hope that they get to a place where they want to make it better for users instead of for Facebook and the app makers. There's no VC that could have invested in Twitter that didn't know what they were getting into, because it's not like Evan has hidden the ball about his lack of focus on revenue. His purpose was to build value and a user base. And it's a very difficult argument to make that they haven't done that. I think the point is to build that value and to see how you can monetize it, rather than to rush into overwhelming it with ads and a terrible user experience for your initial users like me. And that's what my experience with Facebook's been. You know, with each change, it's become, I have less privacy, it's more of a hassle, and there's too much stuff going on. And the deeper you get into Facebook, the more friends you have, that's what your experience is. On Twitter, it in fact, that decreases. I am willing to, like, I do click through to things that I wind up buying from Twitter, from recommendations that I trust. We haven't really acknowledged what trust has meant and how we've diminished it through social networks. There are very few people that haven't self-servingly recommended things that have not damaged their relationships to other people. And so, you know, be it your friend that's made the video that's terrible that they're trying to get you to watch every week, like, that you no longer click on anymore. At the beginning, if I sent you a video, you'd watch it. Now there's 5 billion people sending you videos, most of which are terrible. And it's hard to distinguish between the person that's giving you good recommendations and bad, unless you know them that well.
And it's hard to recoup some of that, whatever the profit would be, if you click on somebody on Twitter and they recommended you buy a pair of shoes or something like that, and you buy the shoes. Twitter doesn't see any of that money, nor likely does your friend, unless your friend is evil, like, or somebody that you shouldn't be trusting in spite of their taste in shoes.
Yet, I would say on Twitter. I mean, I think, like, what they're being really smart about is, like, I mean, I like this because it fits in my view of the world. What they're doing is, like, they're not creating one model. They're experimenting and seeing what's best for their users and best for the folks that are trying to make money off of Twitter as well as themselves. So what I've been really excited to see is, like, the deals that they've made with media companies and the deals that they're making with people aren't cookie cutter deals. And if they don't work, they'll change them. Which to me is, like, again, it's putting the user first and seeing what we'll put up with. There are things I'm happy to pay for. They tend to be about experiences. And so I think that they have an opportunity to invent a different kind of model that's not based on false advertising. And I think we've spent a lot of time online using false advertising and pretending that it works, like banner ads on Facebook, which everybody seems to realize is not effective, but yet those are the options that people have to buy online.
And Facebook had tried a few different things, like adding ads into your friend feed or selling user information, that kind of thing. So it looks like they are trying to be a little bit experimental, but maybe not in the right ways.
Well, I mean, you know, it really depends on where you sit on this. And I sit in the seat of being pro-user rather than pro-investor. Not that I'm anti-investor. I want people to make their money, don't get me wrong. But I think that, like, the Beacon experiment was a very pro investor, advertiser, anti-user strategy that, you know, didn't work for a variety of reasons. However, you know, I will say, like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has said a lot of things about privacy that, you know, haven't touched people necessarily in the right way. That said, I'll pretty much agree with him, even if I don't agree with his methods. Privacy is a 20th century concept. Convenience is a 21st century concept. What he did was not convenient and violated, you know, the sort of agreement users presumed to have with him. And so he may be right in the long term that we're going to be willing to give up all of that. And he just may have been too early, and his methods may have been too anti-user. I think I'm happy to give up my privacy when it benefits me. I'm really not happy when it doesn't.
If you're just joining us, this week we're talking with social design expert Sarah Salovitz. We're talking about the recent evolutions in social media and how well-established brands are approaching social media and all the issues that come with it.
We've been talking about Foursquare and Twitter and Facebook and these companies that have seemed to put a flag in the ground and have become these like huge ideas of institutions that are just completely centered on users and the user experience. I wonder when you go out and you're talking to companies, what is their engagement? Are they trying to figure out how to use these tools, or are they trying to create tools on their own?
Well, I mean, this is my favorite thing about this moment. It's like, it's still so early. There are some companies like Domino's that have decided that this is the way that their business is moving forward. And I'd say Pepsi falls into that category. PG&E, who is bringing their advertising internally instead of using agencies anymore. You know, there are companies that go that way, and then there are other companies that are the opposite. And I think it just depends on, you know, where your stock price sits and who's in your leadership and how needy you are. Domino's, my favorite part of the story, is like really the woman who ran the marketing campaign, who's an amazing woman, she talks about how franchise owners were ready to go out of business. Like these were people that had built these businesses 25, 30 years. And she's, you know, recreated their business for them. And they had to. It was falling apart. Like their pizza sales were disappearing. And so, you know, for some businesses, it's going to work. I don't know which ones. I haven't seen it not work for anybody. But it's really scary for businesses that are used to being closed. Some places are trying to build things internally. Some are really trying Foursquare out. But the thing that interests me really the most about the future is less now than a few years from now. Because I think really Web 2.0 has been, till this point, till Foursquare, about creating choices, like for instance on YouTube, that only 2% of us make. For me, if Web 2.0 is about the 2%, I want to get to the other 98% where we're actually creating choices that are relevant for all of us. And so we're still behind. We have, you know, sort of Apple, where there's a tyranny of no choice, and Google, where there's a tyranny of too much. We don't actually have something where there's the right amount of choice. The future looks like giving me what I want when I want it before I even know I wanted it. And so it's getting ahead of user intent and using all these filters, social and geography, economic filters, all the things that my phone already knows about me to provide me with better choices. And like the best way I can put this is I can't look at Yelp anymore. I don't care if I'm having Chinese food. I don't care if you liked it, because frankly, you're probably the restaurant anyway at this point, because social trust has declined so harshly. But beyond that, what I really want is my phone and my computer know where I like to eat and what I like. Privacy aside, they know. And they know what I've enjoyed because I write about it or I talk about it or whatever it might be. So why not tell me the 5 restaurants that are near me that I would go to that have a reservation at 8:30? I don't need 10,000. I also don't need only the ones that are approved by Apple. So Apple, for instance, because it's too arbitrary. If Apple was good at editorialism or fair or transparent about it, I'd have a different opinion.
Right, and there are those who would argue that Apple is investing in this, in something that they are, it's too big for them. The idea of like culling all these apps and being the editor of all these apps is just a huge, huge thing, and they have to just back off.
Well, then they become Google, and then there's too much choice, and the user experience goes to the only people that can access it are people that are that ahead of the curve. I think there has to be a middle way, and it's got to be about getting ahead of the user. I want to make one final comment about trust, privacy, and integrity, because it's really, you know, central to my identity and important. It's very important to me, like thinking about these terms. And I don't think young people have had the opportunity to consider it because they haven't had choices about it. They have instead done what their friends have done and put everything up or done whatever, which has certainly harmed quite a few people. And, you know, people have made statements or recommendations of things that they haven't been so into or whatever it might be. Where I came to on it in terms of my own privacy is that, as it turns out, the evil people and the evil companies that want to find out everything about me probably can. And so I might as well come up with a system that I was going to feel enough sense of my own personal privacy and ability to keep things to myself, like maybe where my location is, at the same time that I would have some degree of transparency about where I was coming from so that I could maintain this sort of sense of integrity about it. But I think it grows increasingly difficult. And that's why, you know, I come out on the side of transparency instead of maintaining privacy. Because basically, really, what it is that otherwise you only allow the deep, dark companies to be able to have that information anyway without some sort of, you know, without some kind of, you know, some kind of personal relationship to it.
We need a Foursquare for the companies, too. I want to see where they're going and where they're at any given time and what they're spending their money on.
Sarah Salovitz is the founder and CEO of 7Robot, a social design agency. We're talking about how old media companies are viewing their content and their bottom lines in an age where the cost of creation is next to nothing.
When you talk to folks that you're consulting with, mm-hmm. and they come to you with this idea of this tension between the old and the new media, mm-hmm. what's your kind of response to that?
It's a really interesting time, like looking at media generally, because I don't really distinguish between old and new media, or even the methods we get there with. The way I think about it is that we are seeking to build a conversation between people, no matter what methods we use, and so we have to go where they are, and that could be anything from a billboard to an internet video, and I think what's begun to change is that you do have opportunities to participate with your consumers instead of speaking at them. And so the change of boundaries is actually a return to something that we did before. You know, we haven't always had publishing at this high level. And now publishing is really becoming participation because anybody at this point can publish a book or make a movie and actually distribute it for close to zero investment, you know, for basically the cost of publication or the cost of copying and distribution are coming closer and closer to zero, which means that it's not just Time Warner that can make a movie or HBO that can make a movie. Almost anybody can. The distinction becomes, you know, how you build a relationship to an audience or how you build participation within a community such that your content's relevant. Before, you know, only a very few of us could do that. And now anybody from my niece with her ice skating video to someone who wants to make a full feature film in 10 days in their apartment, you know, that person might be able to win the Sundance Audience Prize as they did this year.
Well, I think where you find a lot of the old vanguards getting frustrated is when they see the amount of time, money, and passion that they put into a piece of work, such as the show Lost. And then they see the audience share, the people who are watching that and paying for it by watching advertisements, side by side with the hundreds of millions of people who've watched the David After Dentist video on YouTube, and to the point where this guy has actually made a career out of his son being, drugged out after the dentist. So is that kind of frustration legitimate?
Well, I think, like, it's less whether it's legitimate and more whether it's felt. I mean, my experience has been over the past 3 years living in LA and living in Hollywood that, like, I am a bit of a harbinger of doom. At the beginning, when I first got into, like, when we started to really have a digital media business, I wanted my friends to get paid to make content because that's what I wanted to do. And then I think I realized that, like, my understanding of work changed and that, like, work was something that I had to be paid to do. And Jimmy Wales kind of puts it pretty well, and I sort of changed the way he says it, but whatever. You know, really, what a job is not only something that someone has to pay you to do, but it's also something that someone else wouldn't pay to do. So if you're a sports writer, you're kind of in trouble because lots of people would actually pay to be able to be a sports writer. The change is that it used to be in Hollywood that if you were really good at what you do, if you're a really good writer, you could make it as a writer. Now, it probably doesn't matter how good of a writer you are. There are some people that are going to get to write for a living and to get to do this kind of work. But the opportunities have become so constrained that you as an individual can no longer think that it's about how good of a writer you are. I don't think that that's going to last forever. I think writing's a skill, and it's actually really hard to be a good writer. At the same time, there needs to be a balancing out of these sets of opportunities. There still will be some, but I'm not convinced. I know, in fact, that like most of Hollywood is still, you know, it feels incredibly, you know, insulted and insecure that their jobs are simply changing. Like I have a friend who, you know, he's 40 years old. He's run huge shows ranging from The Daily Show to The Simpsons, and he knows he'll never make as much money again. And so when you're in that situation, like, you know, you can either think it has to do with you, or you can realize that actually the market's changing. And if you're driven by economics, then you need to consider how you can make them up or how you can change what you do.
Is there a support group for showrunners that they can meet together and drink coffee and talk about what it used to be like and where they can go?
None of them are starving. I mean, you think that this is the thing is like, you know, it was awesome that friends of mine had $1 million to sit around Fox and come up with ideas for television shows. They'll probably acknowledge it wasn't the roughest life. They weren't digging coal or coal mining, I suppose. Like I spoke with a guy, Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver, and he realizes that, you know, by the time a kid is 15, they've seen 10,000 hours of television. And if they know that the third person mentioned on Law and Order is the killer, we're probably not creating art anymore. What we're doing is we're replicating a process. It's about a certain number of beats. And if that's what we're calling art, I'm not so sure that that is quite what anybody anticipated. And the way he puts it is that art is about developing new tools and using them in a way that other people haven't seen them before and can experience them. And I guess I think, you know, I use the analogy that it's like obscenity. Like, you know it when you see it. You know what Jim Cameron did with Avatar was that kind of experience that you pay to be a part of. In the same way that, like, Lady Gaga is that kind of experience that's different. She's not selling music. She's selling being a part of Lady Gaga and the House of Gaga.
And that's a wise creative choice on her part.
I think it's the only choice to sell experience now, to be a part of something is what people will buy. And I met this manager in the UK a couple months ago, and he had this band. He used to be a pop star, actually, and he was managing bands at this point. And he had this little band that very few people had heard of. And what they decided to do is they were going to hold a concert on a boat in Loch Ness and look for the Loch Ness monster. They sold a lot of tickets because people wanted to be a part of that. And that's what I think you can do. Like, I think what it is about creating new experiences that people can participate in instead of being shouted at. And I think that that's what a lot of the publication model was. When you had three channels, you could yell at people because they couldn't talk back. Now, you're hard-pressed to see somebody in front of a television without a laptop and a handset, which means that, like, they're talking too. And if you're not making use of those opportunities, they're not going to continue to talk to you because being yelled at isn't that fun. What I had to come to realize, it was like a real realization that actually it's kind of better that a kid in Brazil can make a movie that can reach his community and actually touch their lives, or maybe reach all of us, and that I can see my niece's ice skating video. That was more valuable than my friend who had a $1 million deal at Fox to sit around and come up with television show ideas. I'm not saying that, like, you know, it's greatly beneficial to that one person, but for the world, it meant that we had an opportunity to explore what storytelling could mean for all of us. And I like that world better. I know that that's troubling for people because it means that they don't get to have a job doing what they want to do. I don't think that's what work is. I think work is what you have to be paid to do. So this idea of the past 20 years that, like, I should do what I want and you should pay me for it, sort of ridiculous.
Well, and there's this view of the model of industry, of the entertainment industry, and I'll just use film for an example, that you have to invest in risk in order to have the payoff. So the example would be you have to spend between $10 and $50 million per film for all these films that won't recoup their, you know, their investment in order to have something like Avatar, which has earned its keep time and time again, and it will continue to. Is that just like a completely ridiculous model now? Was that even the model?
Well, I mean, I think it was always, in some ways, it's funny, like, I don't think I realized this until I worked in an office of a startup that was in its VC. You know, there are 10x multiple games. Like, you bet on one and you hope that one wins. It's a very much a gambling model. And, like, you recognize that you're hedging your bets. I'm not so sure that either of those models work in this economy because that we don't all have that sort of stomach for risk. And so you see things like Paramount, who has, you know, $1 million film fund to create something like 100 films. Now, that kind of 10x multiple, like which they've seen on Paranormal Activity, is a lot easier to stomach than the $500 million bet on Avatar. So I think it goes honestly in both directions, that you do have some of that behavior remaining and that there will be some things that are that big that all of us will see, and occasionally they'll fail, but very rarely because the risk is so great. And you'll have a lot more of the $10,000 film that, you know, we've decided is worth marketing and worth spending that kind of multiple on. I'm just not so sure that, like, we shouldn't rethink this altogether. At the same time, I just wonder, like, you know, maybe this is just me being, you know, having a consciousness for longevity, but I'm less interested in a 10x multiple than I am in building a business that has profits. And so, because I think a lot of the 10x multiple in this boom, you know, in buying digital media companies haven't proved their value. So if you look at Bebo was bought for, I think, $890 million and was written down to 30. Now, what that meant was a big media company needed to buy something and check the box. And I think if you look at most of the purchases in this boom, not before it, not after it, that's what they fall under. And instead, you know, we've created companies that are focused on building multiples instead of building value and even revenue. And the idea that your company, like companies that make 10% profit, is actually a really good thing. And suggesting an economy where they make much, much more than that, what it tends to lead to is firing everybody so you can maximize profit. And then what happens is the business falls apart because you're not providing the value you're providing to your consumers. So for me, like, I really want to see an economy where we invest and grow instead of try to gamble and multiply.
I really like that idea because it's just sounds so much more sustainable. It may not be eager in the Gordon Gekko Wall Street viewpoint, but the idea that you will grow your business as you grow your profits and just have that be more of a even relationship just sounds like that sounds like it makes sense. Is that something that when you talk to people in the industry that makes sense to them?
Well, I mean, I think there's two reactions, right? There's like two things that are going on. I think like we have an advertising business that doesn't make sense for the most part anymore. That is largely about exchanging money between friends without building value for anybody. And so there's a vested interest in continuing that. And it's a similar thing in the VC world. Like when I say this, it's not something people like to hear because, you know, A, they feel like maybe I'm picking on them personally, which I'm not, or, you know, I'm uncovering a dirty secret. I had said, you know, to a VC yesterday, I actually said this to, and he's right, I said this to Bob Metcalf that I thought it was unethical. And it's not unethical. Like he was right. He took me on about it, that it's not about ethics. It's about probably like logic is really the question. And what his viewpoint, and he is a VC, and I think, you know, it's not like the VCs are dishonest about what their point is, but they have become more conservative and the deals have changed. And so a lot of deals in this cycle right now become a lot more greedy, which creates a lot less incentives for the entrepreneurs, which means that they're seeking alternative funding sources. So I think, you know, there is some pressure to change that. There's always going to be a portion of this that will be about gambling. I'm just hoping it's not the part that we're so focused on highlighting. Like, you can't change how rich people are going to spend their money or how they're going to buy certain sets of things that are undervalued or the pressures they're going to place on them. But I have to believe that, like, that there are alternatives and that we're beginning to investigate them. And I see my friends who are seeking angel funding instead of VC funding and seeking different relationships with investors now. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm very hopeful that we can start looking at a model that is like that. Because here's the thing. Like, you look at Twitter, mm-hmm. they have 140 employees and they serve billions of people. Now, what that means for a company that has 140,000 employees and serves the same amount of people is not very pretty. And so I just think we need to actually have a real conversation about, like, you know, what work is, how we're going to sustain it, and how we're going to continue to provide both value and increase profits at the same time without, you know, making it such that 20% of the population instead of just 10% is out of work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. It's been fun.
That's Beat.
Sarah Salovitz is the founder and CEO of 7Robot, a social design agency. She can be easily tracked down on the web by her Twitter handle, Dear Sarah. You can also find links to more of her work on the Radio Berkman blog and leave us a comment at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Radio Berkman is produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.